as Africa, as a continent, and having a common position that they would discourage that. And actually, it's doable, it's practical, it can be implemented.
Well, there you have it. After the scandal of Israeli regime hackers manipulating elections in Africa, it's about time Africa chooses its friends wisely. That's the opinion of our guest today, Julius Mbaluto. I'd like to thank him for his insight. And that's the end of yet another edition of Africa Day. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The results of new research conducted in England show a deep level of mistrust of the young black generation towards the police in the country. Most black people in Britain are wary of the police to the extent that they don't want to call the police in case of danger. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. An official report charges UK police with the widespread abuse of their power to strip search children, with black children 11 times more likely than their white peers to be selected by officers for the ordeal. Data collected by the Children's Commissioner found there were at least 2,847 recorded strip searches of children pre-arrest across England and Wales between 2018 and 2022, under stop-and-search powers. The report released says 38% of children strip-searched were black. Black children make up 5.9% of the population, meaning they were six times overrepresented. White children accounted for 42% of strip-searches and make up 74% of the population. The data was analysed for The Guardian by Dr. Christian Posh, a lecturer in crime science at University College London. It shows a black child in England and Wales was 11 times more likely to be strip-searched than their white counterparts. The Children's Commissioner said the ethnic disproportionality was deeply concerning and utterly unacceptable, while the leader of the black police officers said it was another example of institutional racism, which police leaders deny exist. Recently, a report by Louise Casey found the Metropolitan Police to be institutionally racist and riddled with discrimination that was baked in. The Children's Commissioner's study found police did not follow the rules in more than half of strip searches, amounting to widespread non-compliance, and in half of all searches, nothing was found. The report says 1 in 100 strip searches of children took place in public view and 6% were conducted with a police officer present of a different gender to the child being searched. Appropriate adults were not present in 52% of the cases. Of those strip searched, 95% were boys. 14 strip searches were conducted in police vehicles or schools. In 45% of cases, the location was not recorded. The youngest child strip searched was just 8 years old. One child who was strip searched without an appropriate adult present said he felt humiliated by police officers. The Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, said, "I have severe concerns at the ethnic disproportionality shown in these figures and at the lack of appropriate protection for children during what is often a traumatic and humiliating experience." Rachel D'Souza added, "There is sustained attention on this issue not because of a police whistleblower or a government report, but thanks to the bravery of a 15-year-old girl who spoke up. Without her, these failures would have gone uncovered and unnoticed." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. UK Children's Commissioner Dame Rachel D'Souza said across England and Wales, police are strip-searching children as part of stop-and-searches and there is evidence of deeply concerning practice. "My findings include evidence of widespread non-compliance with the statutory safeguards in place to protect children, including the lack of appropriate adults in more than half of strip-searches, and strip-searches being conducted in schools, police vehicles and within public view." UK Children's Commissioner Dame Rachel D'Souza added, "I have serious concerns about the poor quality of record-keeping, which makes transparency and scrutiny very difficult and means that the numbers in this report may only be a minimum." Deborah Coles, the campaign group Inquest, said, "This is state-sanctioned child abuse operating outside of the law. Strip searches are deeply harmful and dehumanising and inflict fear and humiliation. The extent of searches on black children reveals once again how racism is institutionalised in police culture, policy and practice. This abusive and abhorrent practice must end." Abimbola Johnson, who chairs a race oversight board for the National Police Chiefs Council, said it joined other reports as further evidence of prejudice in policing. Abimbola Johnson said, "The repeated theme is a failure of the institution to use its powers lawfully, legitimately, and with a sense of humanity, especially when it interacts with the most vulnerable groups in black community." Johnson added, "These findings present a challenge not only to police officers but also to the statutory agencies whose remit it is to act as a check and balance on policing. These include the Independent Office for Police Conduct, His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, the Home Office and Police and Crime Commissioners." 39 forces across England and Wales provided figures, several did not. Police were unable to respond or offer an explanation about the racial disparity shown by their own data. Chief Constable Craig Guildford for the MPCC said, "It is vital that any police interaction is handled sensitively and that when a police officer considered it necessary to search a child, that it is carried out in line with legislation, policy and procedure. On all but exceptional occasions, such an immediate risk of harm to the young person, this must involve the presence of an appropriate adult." The US broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. A report has found that London's Metropolitan Police Service, the biggest police force in Britain, is riddled with deep-seated racism and misogyny. The review published recently noted that London police have lost the confidence of the public, stressing that it must change itself or risk being broken up. Louise Casey, an expert on victims' rights and social welfare who led the review, said, "It is not our job as the public to keep ourselves safe from the police. It is the police's job to keep us safe as the public." She added, "Far too many Londoners have now lost faith in policing to do that." The review found that the Metropolitan Police, known as the Met, is institutionally racist, highlighting the fact that the department is still disproportionately white. The findings came 24 years after another inquiry found that institutional racism was a key factor in why the Metropolitan Police failed to investigate the murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence. The review was commissioned after a serving police officer raped and killed Sarah Everard, a young marketing executive, in March of 2021, sparking a national outcry. The case was one of a series of scandals that have recently hit the Metropolitan Police. The 363-page report revealed that the organisation hasn't treated violence against women and girls as seriously as other forms of violence. The review reported widespread bullying and discrimination in the department. It said female police officers and staff routinely face sexism and misogyny. According to a preliminary report released in October of last year, Louise Casey revealed that the Metropolitan Police had allowed officers to remain on the job even after they were charged with domestic abuse or racial harassment.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we'll follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming.
Bye.
I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Floodwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadik Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian Mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian Hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berry's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old Berry's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new Berry's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berry's is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They're all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berris cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful the fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Berris Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs that you see here are where Berris begins. Those are the shores of Berris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The French Interior Minister has announced that 13,000 officers will be deployed to counter nationwide protests and strikes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Anadolu news agency reported France on Tuesday, March 28, woke up to a new day of mass mobilizations against the government's pension reform. President Emmanuel Macron is unwilling to budge an inch from his decision to adopt the reform that triggered outrage since it was revealed last year. While trade unions and workers continue to plan massive walkouts and nationwide strikes. This will be the 10th day of mobilization since January with severe walkouts and nationwide protests. The National Railway Company, SNCF, said its traffic would be highly disrupted, according to media reports. The General Labor Confederation's energy branch previously announced in a statement that the workers will be mobilized, as in the past, in the nuclear sites, hydraulic dams, gas stocking units, and distribution sites. The aerial traffic will also be disrupted, and due to the airport staff's walkout, it will be disrupted very badly. Some 20% of the flights at the Paris, Orly, Marseille, Toulouse, and Bordeaux airports have been cancelled as requested by the French Directorate General for Civil Aviation. The walkouts continue in many other sectors, including education and garbage collection. Violence during protest. Acts of violence sustained the protest over the past week when lawbreaker groups set fire to street furniture, various buildings, dumpsters and trash, and threw projectiles at police. Police officers arrested hundreds of suspects Interior Minister Gerald Daramanin recently said authorities foresee grave risks for public order on other days of the month of March. A total of 13,000 police officers will be deployed in the country to intervene in possible troubles. Daramanin added, Paris protests will be secured by 5,500 police officers, he also said. Paris Police Chief Laurent Nunez recently said, that the black blocs are the main problems, with their members being mostly from ultra-left groups. Nunez added that some of them are foreigners coming from other European countries. Pension reform plan, source of popular furor. The French government used the special constitutional powers on March 16th to force the plan through, prompting opposing parties to submit no confidence motions that were later rejected. Emmanuel Macron and Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne decided to invoke Article 49.3 of the Constitution, a mechanism that lets the government adopt a draft bill without parliamentary approval. The decision was driven by fear that lawmakers would be able to block the reforms, as the government does not hold an absolute majority in the legislature. The government revealed the reform project in January, and parliament started examining and debating the draft bill the following month. Workers and trade unions have since expressed growing outrage by holding demonstrations and walkouts. The reform project includes raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 by 2030, requiring at least 43 years of work to be eligible for a full pension. Also, according to the website of RT, French Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin has ordered 13,000 police officers into the streets of France's major cities as protests against the government's controversial pension reforms continue. He said that he is expecting radical activists from abroad to instigate violence at the demonstrations. He announced the deployment, adding that 5,000 of the mobilized officers would be stationed in Paris ahead of marches. Our services anticipate that there will be significant disruptions to the public order, he said, warning that more than 1,000 radical activists, some arriving from abroad, may join the protest in Paris, Nantes or Rennes. He said that these radical activists are mostly left-wingers and anarchists who are known to police. Their goals are to destabilize our republican institutions and bring blood and fire down on France. France has been hit with constant protests and riots since President Emmanuel Macron bypassed Parliament earlier this month to pass a bill raising the retirement age for most workers from 62 to 64. More than a million demonstrators took to the streets, and hundreds were arrested in Paris after clashing with police and lighting fires on the streets of the French capital. The demonstrations in Paris remained mostly peaceful. However, masked rioters in Nantes set cars on fire and hurled rocks at police, who responded with tear gas. Protesters in Paris and Marseille blocked railway lines, while a group of demonstrators set off a smoke bomb in Biarritz airport, triggering alarms and leading to an evacuation. The Council of Europe has condemned the government for using excessive force against the protesters, while France's National Consultative Commission on Human Rights issued a report last week accusing the French police of arresting hundreds of demonstrators without cause. Macron is insistent on keeping his reforms in place, He said in a televised interview last week, "I have no regrets pushing for this necessary reform," adding that he accepts unpopularity as a result. Macron has long argued that France's pension system will go bankrupt unless the retirement age is raised, while his opponents have called on the president to make up for the shortfall by increasing taxes on the wealthy instead.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Imam Ridha alayhi salam's shrine on the occasion of the beginning of the Iranian New Year 1402, that's March 21st, 2023. In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and blessings be upon our Master, Prophet Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the vestige of God remaining on earth. May our souls be sacrificed for his sake. First, I would like to thank Almighty God for once again granting me the opportunity to be present here among the dear people of this city and its respected pilgrims from all around the country after an absence of several years. This is truly the most prominent and best place in our beloved and vast country. I thank God for meeting with you, our dear, faithful, inspired people, the neighbors and the pilgrims, in this important center and base for spirituality, a place where the divine angels descend. In the last 2-3 years, we experienced a general pandemic that, thank God, has been constrained to a considerable extent. I feel it is my duty to sincerely thank all those who made an effort to control this public plague and disease.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I thank the researchers who identified this dreadful virus in different laboratories in the country and developed a vaccine for it, as well as those who produced and distributed this vaccine in the country's pharmaceutical and health centers. And also the doctors and nurses who helped deliver the vaccine to our people and those inclined to receive it. I would also like to thank those who volunteered to help and serve patients alongside our doctors and nurses, and also those who helped provide protective supplies for the disease, such as vaccines and the provisions that were required to be produced. Let us pray to Almighty God to rid our beloved nation, the Muslim nations, and all the people of the world from this calamity. If, God willing, our dear brothers and sisters can reduce the noise a bit, I will speak to you about the things I have prepared to talk about today. The topic that I have chosen for today's speech is taken from the New Year prayer. In the New Year prayer we read, O Transformer of situations and circumstances, transform our circumstances to the best of circumstances. I will talk about transformation today, the transformation of our situation and circumstance. Of course, you need to ask God for the things you want, but you also need to make an effort.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Republic Day. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The Islamic Revolution in Iran triumphed on February 11, 1979. Less than 2 months after this greatest event of the 20th century, Imam Khomeini called on people to take part in a referendum to determine the type of the system of government. Therefore, on 30th and 31st of March, the nationwide referendum was held and over 98.2% of the participants voted yes to Islamic Republic as the ruling system in the country. Thus, April 1st was named as the Islamic Republic Day in the Iranian calendar. This way of determination and formation of the ruling system has not had any precedent in history, even in the so-called democratic societies in the West. In view of the fact that the Iranian nation is a Muslim nation and had struggled for Islam for decades, especially with the leadership of Imam Khomeini, some officials and analysts maintained that there was no need to hold a referendum, but the Imam insisted on a clear and public referendum. The founder of the Islamic Republic said in his message to the Iranian nation, "This referendum will determine the fate of our nation. This referendum will either draw you to freedom and independence or, like before, to suffocation and dependence on others. This referendum is what everyone should participate in it. You can choose any form that you want. You have the right and you're able to write on this paper, democratic republic, royal regime or whatever you want. You are free in this." On this great day, the faithful Iranian people demonstrated their national unity and Islamic solidarity with their decisive vote to fortify the bases of the Islamic Revolution. They altered the history of mankind with their faithful election. The Iranian people dismantled a long history of despotism, oppression, and disgraceful colonialism for good. The Islamic Republic has been the most democratic system of government in the past centuries, far superior to the democratic rule which has been claimed and propagated for decades by higher thinkers and writers in the West. The Islamic Republic is built up of two parts, Islam and people. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, insists of calling it religious popular rule rather than the man-made flawed Western democracy, which has proved its deficiency and even contradiction with the votes of people. The establishment of the Islamic Republic not only proved the Iranian nation's will on their fate, but it also inspired hope in the hearts of the oppressed and downtrodden in the world. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, called April 1st as a feast and said in a message, "The morning of April 1st, which is the first day of Allah's rule, is one of our greatest religious and national feasts. Our nation should hold on this day as feast and keep it alive." Ayatollah Khamenei also said, "There is another feature in our Islamic Republic Day, namely, it is not the feast of us, the Iranian people. Rather, it can be the feast of all those who are Muslims. It means nearly 1 billion people. They, meaning the Muslim nations, have also got used to seeing Islam in the state of defense and passive position, in the state of isolation. When a nation stands in the position of attacking domineering powers and aggressive, incomplete man-made systems and proclaims a republic on the basis of Islam, this is a cause of boasting and honor for Muslim nations. In short, there are various features in the Islamic Republic Day." Clearly, the formation of the Islamic Republic system in Iran created a new theory among the political theories of the East and the West. Article 56 of Iran's constitution reads, "Absolute rule over the world and human being belongs to God, and it is He who has made human being ruler of his social fate. Nobody can dispossess human being of this divine right or put it at the service of the interest of a special individual or group. And the nation wields this God-given right in the ways that will come in the next articles." The establishment of the Islamic Republic system in Iran, besides domestic developments, caused different changes in the region and the world, which were not compliant with the unholy goals of the colonialist powers. In view of this, the enemies of Islam and the Iranian nation hatched various plots to topple this system. These plots began since the first days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and escalated after the formation of the Islamic Republic. They included the imposition of an 8-year war, assassination of political, religious, and revolutionary figures and officials, economic sanctions, creation of barriers on the way of achieving peaceful nuclear energy, assassination of scientists of nuclear field and commanders of the resistance front, and kindling riots in a number of cities. Now the Islamic Revolution has reached its 45th year, and the Islamic Republic has already started the second phase of its life. The leader of the Islamic Revolution says, "Why has the Islamic Republic not suffered the destiny of other systems and revolutions despite this much of enmity? What is the reason and the mystery? I tell you that the splendid and honorable mystery of this system and the durability of this system are these two words, Republic and Islamic. The accompanying of these two words with one another, and the creature that has been formed of these two words, should naturally be permanent. Both the Republic and the Islamic, people and Islam. Republic means people, and Islamic means Islam, religious popular rule. The feat of our great Imam was that he created this thought. The theory of the Islamic Republic, brought it among various political theories, as in that era, different political theories were in contact with each other in the East and the West in the field of political issues and political mentalities. He materialized it, realized it. It was not merely the creation of a theory, but he materialized it and created the Islamic Republic system. This was the Imam's feat.